From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today we'll speak with the father of David Hicks, the Australian man captured with the Taliban 2 years ago. He's being held in Guantanamo Bay and will be tried by a military tribunal. His father came to New York to make a plea to the U.S. government.
I'm over here to push and put pressure on the Australian government and the American government about trying to see my son in Guantanamo Bay. I haven't seen him for 2 years.
Then the clock is ticking towards California's first recall gubernatorial election. Who will be in the race? We'll speak with two potential candidates. Arianna Huffington says maybe. Commander Peter Camejo says he'll run. And we'll talk with the man who started the recall drive. We'll go to Jenin to speak with a U.S. activist hit by shrapnel from an Israeli concussion grenade as he was protesting what the Israeli military calls the security wall, what others call the apartheid wall in the West Bank. And Radio for Peace International is fighting to stay on the air as the UN-mandated University for Peace in Costa Rica says it's shutting it down. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon is setting up a system that would allow investors to earn money if they could predict key events in the so-called war on terror, including assassinations and suicide bombings. The program, known as Policy Analysis Market, is a project of the Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, and two private companies, including a subsidiary of The Economist magazine. John Poindexter is overseeing the project. In the 80s, he was President Reagan's national security advisor, was convicted of lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra arms deal. The system yesterday came under intense criticism by Democratic Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon and Byron Dorgan of North Dakota. Wyden said, quote, "The idea of a federal betting parlor on atrocities and terrorism is ridiculous and it's grotesque." Dorgan added, quote, "Can you imagine if another country setting up a betting parlor so that people could go in and bet on the assassination of an American political figure or the overthrow of this institution or that institution?" DARPA yesterday defended the project as another tool in helping the U.S. fight the so-called war on terror. The government would be able to monitor all investments looking for tips for possible upcoming attacks. The market will be based on events that occur in or are connected to Egypt, Jordan, Iran, Iraq, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Turkey. $600,000 have already been spent creating the system, and the Pentagon wants $8 million more for the next 2 years. J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup have agreed to pay more than $300 million to settle charges they knowingly deceived investors by helping Enron hide billions of dollars in loans. J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup, two of the nation's largest banks, knowingly portrayed loans as cash generated by Enron. According to the New York Times, what the banks did was deceptive, but not illegal. The Times reports, quote, "These settlements are a strong signal that banks, accountants, and lawyers can now be held responsible if a transaction is legal in every respect, but results in an outcome that deceives investors." President Bush will meet with Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Saud Faisal today to respond to Saudi criticism of the Congressional 911 report. The Washington Post reports it appears the Saudi government may urge Bush to declassify 28 pages within the report that detail connections between the Saudi regime and the 911 attack. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi, and the New York Times reports classified section shows Saudis poured hundreds of millions of dollars into charities and other groups that assisted the hijackers. The number of AIDS cases in the United States has increased for the first time in a decade. This according to a new report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The overall number of new AIDS cases jumped 2.2% to just over 42,000 among homosexual and bisexual men. The number of new cases jumped over 7%. This news from Indiana, 4 days before he was scheduled to be executed, Darnell Williams has been given a short new lease on life. Yesterday, Indiana Governor Frank O'Bannon postponed Friday's execution to allow for last-minute DNA testing. Williams was convicted of killing two in 1986, but he never admitted to the murder. Meanwhile, in Philadelphia yesterday, attorneys for death row prisoner Nicholas James Yaris say new DNA testing proves he was not guilty of a 1983 rape and murder. The Associated Press reports he could become the first person on Pennsylvania's death row to be cleared by DNA evidence. For the second time in 3 months, Democratic state lawmakers from Texas fled the state yesterday in an attempt to block a Republican move to redraw the state's congressional districts to be more friendly to the GOP. 11 of the 12 Democrats went to Albuquerque. 3 months ago, members of the Texas House holed themselves up in a Holiday Inn in Oklahoma. This fall, New York City will open the nation's first public school devoted to gay, bisexual, and transgender students. About 100 students are expected to enroll in the Harvey Milk High School, named after San Francisco's first openly gay supervisor who was assassinated in 1978. Meanwhile, the Vatican is launching a worldwide campaign against marriage between same-sex couples. Next week, the Vatican will release a document entitled Considerations Regarding Proposals to Give Legal Recognition to Unions Between Homosexual Persons. It outlines how politicians and members of the church can oppose same-sex unions. And President Bush signed the Burmese Freedom and Democracy Act to impose tough new sanctions on Burma. Bush also condemned the detention of pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. And a California judge will decide this week whether a lawsuit against oil giant Unocal for its involvement in Burma can proceed. The lawsuit alleges the Burmese military used forced labor and rape to clear the way for their oil pipeline. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's foreign minister urged Palestinians to crack down on militants after a soldier's body was found in northern Israel yesterday. There was no claim of responsibility from any Palestinian militant group. In Washington, President Bush is scheduled to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today to discuss the so-called peace plan. Bush met with Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas last Friday.
Settlement activities in Palestinian land and construction of the so-called separation wall on confiscated Palestinian land continue, we might soon find ourselves at a situation where the foundation of peace, a free Palestine state living side by side in peace and security in Israel, is a factual impossibility. Nothing less than a false settlement freeze will do, because nothing less than a false settlement freeze will work. For the sake of peace and for the sake of future Palestinian and Israeli generations, all settlement activities must be stopped, now, and the wall must come down.
The wall is a problem, and I've discussed this with Ariel Sharon. It is very difficult to develop confidence between the Palestinians and the Israel with a wall snaking through the West Bank. And I will continue to discuss this issue very clearly with the Prime Minister. As I said in my statement today, he has issued a statement saying he's willing to come and discuss that with us. And I appreciate the willingness to discuss it.
And that was George Bush and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. Yesterday, Israeli troops fired tear gas and rubber bullets at a group protesting the construction of the so-called security wall. Haaretz newspaper reports five pro-Palestinian activists were injured, three of whom were internationals. One American, Jordan Flaherty, was struck in the leg at close range and hospitalized. He speaks to us from Jenin. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jordan.
Hi.
Can you tell us what happened yesterday?
Well, we were in the village of Anin in the northwest of the West Bank, not far from the city of Jenin, where there's a large group of international activists based there from across Europe and across the U.S. And we've been working with people from these villages throughout the entire year and talking to them about what they're facing. And people in these villages are seeing no signs of peace from the Israelis. They're seeing settlements continuing to expand. There's 5,000 more settlers living in the West Bank since the beginning of the year. There's still as many checkpoints as there ever have been. And worst of all, the construction of the wall continues to steal their land. In this village that we were in, the village of Anin, they've lost 3,000 acres to the construction of the land. It's a village of just about 2,000 people who've lost most of their most usable farmland. They've lost 22,000 olive trees. 112 of the families of this village lost land. So working with the people of this village, we had a demonstration marching up to the wall. More than 200 people from the village, as well as more than 50 international activists from around the world, and more than 30 Israeli peace activists marched up to the wall and had a demonstration in front of it. Some of the activists were shaking on the fence to pull it open. Some used wire cutters to start to clip it open. As soon as the activists even came near the fence, the soldiers began firing. They shot rubber bullets. They threw concussion grenades. I was actually hit by the shrapnel of a concussion grenade in my arm, not in the leg. And they also threw tear gas directly into the crowd. Despite this, people continued to demonstrate and were able to tear down a portion of the wall. We continued to demonstrate and then pulled back the demonstration away from the wall. People from the village felt it was a success, that at least they were able to get out to some word to the world that this is what's happening, that they're losing their land at a drastic rate. And it's not just happening in this village. It's happening all around the entire region, not just on the side, the western side, but they're also building another wall down through the eastern side.
What exactly does the wall look like?
At this portion of the wall, it looks like a fence about 15 feet high with razor wire on the top, and on each side of the fence there's roads that's just for settlers, for Israeli settlers and for military vehicles. And then on each side of those roads there's another row of razor wire. So the fence goes about 30 meters wide with the razor wire, the road, and then the actual fence, which has electronic detectors on it. So we've gone up and touched it, and within about 3 minutes of touching the fence, soldiers come up. They can sense within 20 meters when it's been touched exactly where the location is.
And now, so, you got struck yesterday by the shrapnel from an Israeli military concussion grenade?
That's right. Yeah, they say immediately before people even approached the fence, they started firing rubber bullets and throwing concussion grenades. Actually, the first thing they did was throw a concussion grenade directly into the crowd.
And so what is your next move now? You're out of the hospital.
And I want to emphasize that the damage to us is nothing compared to what Palestinians face. Just next to the village of Amin is the village of Barta, which is entirely encircled by the wall. And just 4 days ago, a four-year-old named Mahmoud Kubha was killed by Israeli soldiers while waiting at a checkpoint. And it wasn't that they were trying to cross the checkpoint in a hurry. They were just sitting, and the soldier said his gun slipped, and he fired several shots into the four-year-old and killed him. And that's what Palestinians are facing every day. 6 days ago, 20 Palestinians were arrested at the Amin area while just trying to cross over and to go into work. So this is what Palestinians are facing every day.
Jordan Flaherty is with the International Solidarity Movement, struck in the leg yesterday by a concussion grenade thrown by an Israeli soldier as he was protesting the so-called security wall. And we will continue to cover this issue this week. Today, George Bush meeting with Ariel Sharon in Washington. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move now to David Hicks, the Australian-born Islamic militant held in a U.S. compound at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He has admitted receiving training from al-Qaeda, but his father says he is not a terrorist. Terry Hicks retraced his son's steps through Afghanistan and Pakistan, said he'd been told by both sides of the conflict in Afghanistan that his son was not trained in terrorism by al-Qaeda. U.S. authorities have said David Hicks, who was captured fighting with the Taliban in Afghanistan almost 2 years ago, is likely to be tried by a special military tribunal on unspecified charges. He has come to New York. Terry Hicks has come to New York to plead the case for his son and joins us in the studio right now. On the telephone with us is Michael Ratner, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of David Hicks's attorneys. Welcome to Democracy Now! Terry Hicks, can you tell us why you're here?
Well, I'm here to try and put some pressure on the American government. I haven't seen David for 2 years. I have no access to David at Guantanamo Bay except by Red Cross letters, which, when they do arrive, they are heavily censored. We've had about seven letters in that time that David's been at Guantanamo Bay, but I'd like to either speak to him personally on the phone or go there and speak.
Why can't you see him?
Because the American military say that we just can't, and that's it, end of the story. They're adamant about that. No legal access either with the or family access. That's what they tell us.
What has he told you in his letters?
Well, not much, really. It's just generalisation. Most of the things he tries to tell us about the camp are heavily censored, so we don't know what he's telling us. Uh-huh. So it's just generalisation, how's the family, send photos, and, you know, it's just... That's all he can say. The rest of the stuff, as I say, is censored.
When Tony Blair came to address Congress in the last few weeks and then meet with Bush, he pushed for the two men from Britain who are being held on Guantanamo to be sent back to Britain to be tried there, like John Walker Lynn was tried in the United States. What's happening with the Australian government calling for your son to be returned?
Well, nothing. The Australian government, I don't think, have been working hard enough with the American government to try and solve this business. I think Mr. Blair done a great favour for myself by working with the American government with the English, and then they had to include the Australians. I think the Prime Minister, Mr. Howard, was then embarrassed into a situation where then he had to do the same thing. Otherwise, it would have just been left to go along as it is.
Michael Ratner, what is the legality of this? David Hicks being held in Guantanamo with the other prisoners there. Family can't visit him for almost 2 years now since he was taken there.
Well, there's nothing legal about this, Amy, at all. He's been there 19 months now. He hasn't seen an attorney. He hasn't been able to communicate with his father. He's probably undergoing 30 to 40 interrogations. We don't know, but very likely he's undergoing what they call stress and duress, which in my view is a form of torture. And now, without actually having seen an attorney, they now want to charge him and take him before a tribunal. Presumably then they'll let him see an attorney. But by that time, it's a little bit like the horse is out of the barn. I mean, at that point, what's he facing? There isn't really, it's unprecedented. In 800 years, I would say, of history since the Magna Carta, Anglo-American legal history, we haven't seen a situation where you can simply pick up people, hold them in a detention facility, not give them any access to an attorney, and then take them before a kangaroo court-type tribunal. That's what's happening to David. That's what's probably going to happen to a lot of other people. David is a case in which they're trying to smooth the way for that. What's remarkable about David's case in a certain way is they picked a very low-level person, a person who essentially, you know, as his father says, as Terry says, was fighting on behalf of the Taliban as a soldier. Now, there's no crime in fighting on behalf of the Taliban. People may not like the Taliban. They may be opposed to it. But to be a soldier in an army of the Taliban against the Northern Alliance, which was trying to overthrow the government, is not a crime. Yet the United States is defining a new crime. They're going to call that aiding terrorism, but of course it's not. It's fighting on behalf of the Taliban. I want to say that I think that, you know, that Terry Hicks, David's father, has been incredible in this. I mean, it's not that he necessarily agrees with what his son has done, but he has been incredibly supportive. Yesterday, we put up a cage on the corner of Broadway and Bond Street in which his father sat in the cage in an orange jumpsuit, answering really scores of reporters' questions about what was happening. The cage was 8x6. It's very small when you actually see it on the street. That's where David Hicks is now, And when you look at that cage, you really see how oppressive the conditions are.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We'll be back with Terry Hicks, the father of David Hicks, an Australian man being held on Guantanamo, and attorney Michael Ratner. Stay with us.
Camera across the street, supposed to be protecting me, storing every little file. Make a promise and take a while. Hooked up to a satellite, make sure the world's behaving right. I don't mean to bust your groove, think it's time we made a move. Freedom isn't free tonight. Freedom isn't free tonight. Indoctrinated here.
Freedom isn't free tonight, Jesse Dayan, here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Terry Hicks, the father of David Hicks, an Australian man who has been on Guantanamo Bay being held by the U.S. military for almost 2 years, been unable to see his family. Michael Ratner, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, is on the telephone with us. They held a news conference yesterday in downtown New York outside the Center for Constitutional Rights, where they set up a cage, and in an orange jumpsuit, Terry Hicks got inside and answered questions to show the condition that his son is being held in at the U.S. Naval Base in Cuba. How did your son end up joining the Taliban?
This is something that I'm going through at the moment, or have been going through with Pakistan and Afghanistan, to try and trace the transition from Pakistan to Afghanistan into the Taliban.
He went first to Pakistan?
Yes.
To the madrasas there?
Yes. David converted to Islam in Adelaide, in South Australia. He attended a Islamic college for 9 months, and then decided that to further his education in the Islamic religion, he needed to go to Pakistan, which he did. He attended the madrasas. Unfortunately, some of those madrasas that these people attend, they do test. David had to go into Kashmir with the Pakistan militant group, which was the Lashkar-e-Taiba, and they'd spend like 3 weeks in the front line and 3 weeks back studying and all this sort of thing. And then I did receive a letter from him saying that he was going into Afghanistan. And then the second letter I got was he wasn't happy with the Taliban situation. He thought they were very un-Islamic. And I thought, well, that's fair enough. But then the next thing I know, he's in Afghanistan with the Taliban. So what I've been trying to do is find out what the transition, why this development happened. And it's very, very hard to find that information.
Where was he captured?
A place called Pulikumri. A lot of the people are saying that David was captured fighting with the Taliban, but he was actually picked up at a checkpoint going back to Pakistan in a van with several other people. They arrested David, and they did let the other people go because they had no tie to any terrorism or organisations.
Were they Pakistani or Australian?
No. They were Pakistani, as far as I know. I'm not sure. So he was arrested at that checkpoint. He was held for 10 days by the Northern Alliance. I actually spoke to the arresting military person, and I spoke to the commandant of the garrison where David was detained, and he said at that stage he was away. When he came back, which was after the just after the 10 days of detainment there by David, was, and he told me that the Americans came in after 10 days and demanded David because he was a foreigner and took him away. This gentleman told me that he would never have released David to the Americans because there was no evidence to prove that he was involved with the Taliban or terrorism or whatever. He said he would have had to interrogate David to find out himself. So he told me he would never have handed him over. By the time he got back there, it was too late. He'd been taken by the Americans. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, I'm finding a lot of conflicting things to what I was told earlier.
And what are you hearing from men who've been released from Guantanamo?
I did speak to another gentleman that was in the next cell to David that was released last year sometime it was. And apparently him and David had become quite good friends. And David was acting as a go-between the prisoners and the guards. I asked him a question because the media were saying that, well, the government had said that David had threatened to kill the American guards. And he was astounded. He said no, because David's got a good rapport with the guards, and also because he speaks Arabic, Pashto and Urdu, that he could negotiate with the guards for the prisoners. And he just couldn't say anything bad about him. So this, to me, there's just too many conflicting stories of demonising David in the early piece to the public to make him sound like a bad person.
Well, Michael Ratner, what are the charges against David Hicks?
Well, that's one of the big mysteries here, that he has not been charged yet. He's been held for 19 months. He's been designated by the president for a tribunal. And, of course, what's interesting about that designation is the president has said the people in Guantanamo are bad people and that they're killers. The president then does the designation for the tribunals, and if and when he's charged and if and when he's ever convicted of anything, the only appeal from a tribunal is to the president. So that essentially the president is both the accuser and the executioner in the case. So there are no charges yet. What we suspect is the United States is going to do a broad kind of charge, almost similar to what they did in some ways with Lynn Stewart, the lawyer who had some of these charges, the most worst, heinous ones of those, dismissed, which is sort of aiding terrorism charge. And it just doesn't make any sense because fighting for the Taliban is not aiding terrorism, it's fighting for the Taliban. But the United States, of course, is just taking a very broad brush and trying to basically tar everybody with aiding terrorism who it doesn't like or who wants to justify keeping in these kind of detention facilities forever and ever. The problem here is what's facing David is very difficult because on the one hand, the U.S. asserts that it can keep people in Guantanamo forever without any charges. In other words, it can just pick up people, label them enemy combatant, keep them there forever. At the same time, it then will face David conceivably with some kind of a charge and say, well, you either go to the tribunal or you plead guilty to something like 20 years. At that point, what does a guy like David Hicks do? The government says, we'll keep you forever anyway. So he's in a very difficult place in the sense that the government is really not just playing hardball, but basically violating every precept of law. It should also be understood that what the British have done here, which is negotiate at least no death penalty, which the Australians have now followed, is really window dressing. Obviously, it's good not to have your client face the death penalty. But what they haven't done is really insist that lawyers go down immediately to see those people and that they be tried in some kind of regular court instead of these kangaroo military-type tribunals. So the British really have, because of their own public opinion in their country, and the Australians to a lesser extent, have done something, but nothing close to what they should be doing to protect their citizens and this wholesale violation of rights. It's probably one of the worst aspects I've seen in this war of terror is what they're doing to people in the belief that they don't have to give them a writ of habeas corpus or anything else.
Terry Hicks, what has driven you to take this trip, going from Australia to Pakistan, to Afghanistan, to New York? What are you doing in Australia?
What am I
doing? What was your job in Australia?
I can't tell you my job. I'm sorry.
So what has driven you to take this long journey to retrace your son's steps?
There's many things that have driven me to this. To me, there was a lot of discrepancies that were coming from the Australian government. They went through a demonising period with David to make him... I mean, Senator Hill, the Defence Minister, earlier said he was one of the worst 20 people in the world. Well, my question to him was, you tell me who the other 19 are, so I have some sort of gauge to work by. And comments like that that come out to the Australian public were then saying, oh, well, he must be involved in all this terrorism, which of course he wasn't. So I've been working a campaign, particularly in Australia, to swing the public attitude towards David. And people are now starting to say, well, this is a bit strange. After 19 months, there's no charges been laid. What the hell's going on?
I'm looking at the piece in the New York Times about your news conference yesterday, and it says U.S. officials have not said what they intend to do with Mr. Hicks, one of a handful of military detainees whose cases are particularly complex because they involve citizens of two close allies. Last week, Australian and British officials announced they had reached agreements with the U.S. to ensure fair treatment for Mr. Hicks and two Britons also being held at Guantanamo Bay, the United States Naval Base in Cuba. In Mr. Hicks's case, Australian officials said the Americans have promised not to prosecute him on any capital offense. If he is convicted, he may be able to serve time in an Australian jail under the accord. What accord?
I don't know. I don't know what this accord is. Like Mr. Ratner was saying, there's too much window dressing. They're bringing up words that I don't understand what they are. Probably the lawyers do. The military tribunal, to me, it's as a basic thing, sounds quite unfair, where you've got a panel of seven people with one lawyer. My lawyer that's acting for David sits in as an advocate. He can't do much. And he knows all David's background. The person that will be defending David knows nothing about David's background. They haven't come to us to ask about different questions on what
the David's. Person defending David is not the attorney of your choice?
No, that's right.
Well, Michael Ratner, you're one of David Hicks's attorney. What does that actually mean?
Well, what it means is what's being said here is that the only attorney so far that might be allowed to see David in the near future is a military attorney. And of course, even if that military attorney is a good defense attorney, he goes down there and he sees David, and David, you know, he's only surrounded by military and CIA and FBI and interrogating him, and then a military guy comes down there, and what's he going to think about that? So he doesn't, and that attorney can't necessarily challenge the entire system, which is what attorneys at the center and others like David's attorney in Australia are willing to do. So what's really happening here is the U.S. is basically going to give him at best a military attorney, and of course they haven't even given him that yet. The military attorney was supposed to even go down there a couple of weeks ago, and then all of a sudden that he was pulled from it because of the so-called negotiation by the Australians, etc. So he doesn't really have an attorney. He hasn't had one for 19 months. And one of the aspects of this is because of these 30 to 40 interrogations that he's probably undergone in 19 months essentially in isolation, is he may have made some statements to them basically to get out from under where he is. And those statements, despite the fact they were taken by without an attorney and by coercion essentially, will be able to be used at any kind of military tribunal, something really unheard of under Anglo-American judicial system. So there's nothing fair about this. We're seeing really a danger to justice in general and a danger to all people in terms of the authority of the United States, their claimed authority to just imprison people without charges.
Well, Terry Hicks, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Father of David Hicks, who is imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay, has been for almost 2 years. His father has not been able to see him. And Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. Thank you both. Well, the clock is ticking towards California's first recall gubernatorial election. October 7th has been set as the election date. Campaigns promise to be short, expensive, and fierce. There's not a lot of time for strategic planning. Secretary of State Kevin Shelley announced last week more than 1.3 million valid signatures on petitions to oust Gray Davis from office. The number of signatures is far more than needed to qualify for the recall. The October 7th ballot will give voters two choices. First, they can vote yes or no on whether to recall Governor Davis. Then they can choose a successor listed on the same ballot. If a majority votes yes on the recall, the next governor of California will be the one who gets the most votes, not necessarily the majority, making the election a total free-for-all. To complicate matters further, three separate lawsuits are now challenging the way the recall vote is held. Either way, candidates hoping to replace Governor Gray Davis have only until August 9th to get into the race. GOP Congressmember Daryl Issa is the only declared major party candidate so far. He bankrolled the recall drive with $1.7 million of his own money. Issa and other Republican forces have accused Davis of steering California into a $38 billion deficit. California's Democratic office holders have closed ranks behind Davis and say they won't run. However, Davis's approval rating has fallen to around 20%. He's been campaigning against the recall for months on the basis of its cost, now put at $35 million. Actor Arnold Schwarzenegger is, quote, leaning against running, but has made no final decision, a senior advisor said yesterday. Former Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon has said he'll look hard at running if Schwarzenegger doesn't. Also considering are GOP businessman Bill Simon, who lost to Davis in November, California Senator Tom McClintock, and former Congressmember Michael Huffington. We're joined today by two other possible candidates, as well as the man who was in charge of the recall initiative. We're joined by Peter Camejo, who won 5% of the vote as the Green Party candidate for governor in 2002. He's announced his intention to run in this election. Arianna Huffington is a columnist and an author. Her latest book is Pigs at the Trough, How Corporate Greed and Political Corruption Are Undermining America. There's a grassroots campaign based in San Francisco called Run Arianna Run, which is working to draft her into the race for governor. She has not yet declared her candidacy. And Ted Costa, an anti-tax activist who started the recall initiative. He's CEO of People's Advocate. Let's begin with Ted Costa. Why did you push this recall? It is unprecedented.
Well, you know, government at all levels in the United States of America gets its authority from the consent of the governed. Without the consent of the people, government has nothing whatsoever. And what's happening in California is the people do not consent to the current government that we have in California at the state level.
Arianna Huffington, your response to the recall initiative.
Well, I completely disagree with what Ted said. I mean, there is a process by which in 2006, Californians who do not consent to Gray Davis could throw him out. In any case, he wouldn't be on the ballot in 2006. But he was just elected fair and square 8 months ago, 8.5 months ago. You know, let me just say that I can spend the next hour telling you all the things wrong with Gray Davis and his policies. I mean, I think it's ludicrous that he's now presenting himself as a progressive politician just to save his skin. But nevertheless, I'm opposed to the idea of buying signatures because, after all, despite Davis's low approval ratings and despite the feeling that he's totally owned by special interests, had it not been for Daryl Issa bankrolling this campaign to the tune of $1,200,000 and maybe more, these signatures would not have been collected. They are collected often by people who are not even Californians, who had been brought in from other states. So there are a lot of very sleazy elements to this recall. But my point of view is that the Democratic strategy of just circling the wagons around Davis and not fielding any major Democrats is very dangerous, because it's really playing Russian roulette with the state at a time when the last thing California can afford is a Republican governor who will cut taxes, cut even more spending programs, and basically perpetuate the disastrous policies of Pete Wilson, which, frankly, were largely followed through by Gray Davis in many, many instances, including Prop 21 that has filled our jails, including the failed drug war that we are continuing to pursue with vigor, and the fact that we have major tax sheltering of business income and profits that, if it was paid, would have meant that we wouldn't have had to cut so many services.
Will you run for governor?
I'm seriously looking at it. I'm meeting with a lot of community leaders, the activists that you mentioned in San Francisco, led by Van Jones of the Ella Baker Center. They came over and met with me over the weekend. So I'm seriously looking at it. I definitely would not want to see a field that did not include a progressive alternative to a Republican takeover of the state.
Peter Camejo, you're the Green Party candidate for governor. You already ran against Gray Davis. You're going to do it again, this time on the recall ballot?
Well, in the in the July 16th poll taken, I'm not right now in first place in the Bay Area among liberals and among independents in California. That's the first time that any third party candidate in any category has gone into first place among the people, and as you may know, this is enormous for the Green Party. We've been building the party for 10 years, and we have a shot here at making an enormous impact. The biggest problem we have in California is that we tax the poor. The poorest 20% are taxed at 11.3%, and the richest 1% is taxed at 7.2%. That is, we have a totally regressive state and local taxes in California. That the Democrats and Republicans have both done. We had an enormous income for the state, unparalleled in the history of California while Davis was in office. A $30 billion surplus came in above the amount that's necessary to keep the budget balanced. He lost all $30 billion plus an additional $30 billion, plus he lost his $30 billion in the energy crisis. The people of California are completely and totally fed up with him, and I'm 100% for recalling him. I think the right of the people to take out any politician. This is not an impeachment. An impeachment means you violated the law, you did something like that, and you're tried. This is the will of the people. Every poll shows Davis will be removed. And in fact, when you go from likely voters to registered voters, which means more poor people, more people of color, the polls get worse for Davis. They're 54-39% among registered voters to throw him out. I think it's a mistake to defend him in any way, shape, or form, or to oppose this recall. It doesn't matter that the Republicans started it. It reflects the will of the people of California. Therefore, I completely support the recall.
Arianna Huffington, might you run against your ex-husband, against Michael Huffington?
No, you know what, Amy? I'm first of all a mother, and we have two daughters together who are 12 and 14, and I would never put my children through this. So, if my ex-husband decides to go ahead and run, that would preclude my run, not for any other reason, but because, I mean, you can imagine what it would be like for children to have their parents running in the same race.
On the issue of Enron, which you take on in your books, Pigs in the Trough, you have the energy crisis, which is very much held against Gray Davis. You have Enron a good deal behind that energy crisis and all the fraud that it represents. Do you have, first, the leading Republicans in this country who helped bring the president to office, like Ken Lay, who was one of his pioneers, first going at Gray Davis in one way, and then now with this recall in another?
Well, I would say that Enron and the energy crisis is a whole other problem, which shows both just the power of these companies in the state, but also the fact that the Bush administration has really barely begun to do anything to hold them accountable, both in the energy crisis and in a lot of other areas. So that's one of the problems, frankly, with Gray Davis, that he hasn't really taken this to the people. I mean, there's so much that can only be done if the public is outraged. I mean, as you know, with a deadlocked legislature, with an administration in Washington that basically is there to protect the interests of its major donors. Only when the public is outraged do we see change. And you remember, the public got outraged, the administration got rid of Harvey Peet at the SEC. The public got outraged, Henry Kissinger had to resign as a potential chairman of the 9/11 committee. There is a string of successes when the public is mobilized and outraged. And that's why I think we need a leader in California who has the capacity to take these issues to the public and outrage them, because our system is too broken to function any other way at the moment.
Let me ask Ted Costa, who started the recall initiative. If the lieutenant governor, Bustamante, who set the date, if Gray Davis were to resign even the day before the recall vote, would that automatically make Bustamante governor and then invalidate the whole recall vote because it's not a recall vote for Bustamante as governor?
No. Once the signature has been certified, people are guaranteed an election. What you would have is Cruz Bustamante would be the temporary governor until such a time as there was be an election. And you should also know that we have already 2 million signatures. By September 1st, we will have 2.4. 900,000 of them were paid signatures, and we have more than enough signatures without Paralyzer's paid signatures to qualify this thing. And the notion that we heard earlier is just a totally erroneous notion that people come from outside. It was rejected by the Superior Court, it was rejected by the Court of Appeals, and it was rejected by the Supreme Court because we found all those signatures and we never turned them in. Arianna Huffington, stop lying to people about this.
But there were, you did have people who came from out of town. You may not have used the signatures they provided you with, but there were people who were paid.
People don't have the right to travel in this country? Is that what you're saying?
Oh,
people don't have the right
to
travel?
What I'm saying is that these were not even Californians who were collecting signatures, and they were doing it for the money. And I frankly think that this is one change that should happen. The initiative system was originally intended to be a populist expression, and the minute you are able to hire people, to pay people to collect signatures, it becomes another tool of special interest. And sure, sometimes it can also be the expression of the people, but it's become too blunt an instrument. And I would definitely advocate that we go back to the original intent and only be able to collect signatures if volunteers and citizens and people who are concerned about an issue are willing to go out and take the time and collect the signatures.
I agree with that concept. It's a very good concept. However, the United States Supreme Court will not allow us to outlaw professional signature gatherers.
Peter Camejo, will you run if Arianna Huffington runs?
Hello?
Peter Camejo, will you run if...
I am already running, and I'm urging Arianna Huffington to enter the race, and I'm offering to where the Green Party, we're going to offer to form a block with her. And as we approach the end of the election, if it is possible for us to win by unifying our forces, we'll take whatever steps are necessary. But I just want to add one thing. Unions in California pay for signatures. Everybody pays for signatures. This is the way people go out, and they get paid very, very little. The point is not whether they get paid or not. The point is what is the will of the people of California. And Davis, by the way, Davis, let me just throw this in. He loved Kenneth Lay. he used Kenneth Lay as his main advisor on what to do on the energy crisis. And he turned around and wrote a check for $43 billion to all these corporations that were stealing and destroying California. So that, you got to understand something. The difference between Davis and the Republicans is that Davis calls himself a Democrat. The point is we need someone like Arianna Huffington who's willing to fight for the rights of the people and to represent the mass of the people of California and their interests and not for special interest and money interest. And that's why I'm very happy to hear her considering this, and I want to really encourage her to enter that. We differ a little bit here on about the recall, but I'm absolutely believe that the people of California are looking for alternatives.
So although you're encouraging her to run, you would not pull out if she does?
Well, it is. We don't know if she's going to run to begin with. And secondly, the Green Party's base now is primarily on people of color. And we need to have me in this campaign as a Latino. I'll be the only person that's not a European American, even though the population of California is a majority non-European American. And if we're going to mobilize the African American Latinos and the entire community that needs to, for us to be able to have a progressive win, I have to be in this campaign. The Green Party has to be in this campaign. We have thousands and thousands of activists throughout California. We've built an organization for 10 years. And because Arianna Huffington enters, that opens up the possibility of a victory, but only if we're in an alliance working together is that going to be possible.
Well, on that note,
Peter and I had a great long meeting on Saturday, and I really respect so much what he's done and the passion with which he's campaigned for people who don't have a voice, certainly not in a Sacramento dominated by big donors and special interests. And all that will be worked out. I think here we have for the first time the possibility of not just sending a message, but electing a progressive governor, just because of the way the recall provisions, as you mentioned at the beginning, allow somebody to become governor simply by getting the majority of the votes, but not a simple majority, the plurality. So that is kind of unique. And out of chaos come opportunities. There's no question it's going to be a chaotic 2.5 months. But what's wrong with that? Frankly, the predictability of the system that has limited choices and has meant that the two parties had a lock on incumbent re-election is something that we need to shake up anyway.
Thank you very much for being with us. Arianna Huffington may run for governor in California and be on the recall ballot. Among other things, she is author of Pigs at the Trough, How Corporate Greed and Political Corruption Are Undermining America. Peter Camejo also on the line with us. He is the declared Green Party candidate for governor on the recall ballot. And Ted Costa, anti-tax activist who started the recall initiative, CEO of People's Advocate. Stay with us.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you to cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs.
You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Out, Today, we're going to talk about Radio for Peace International, the only shortwave radio station dedicated to peace and social justice in the Western Hemisphere. The station listened to around the world via shortwave may soon be off the air. Radio for Peace International is housed on the grounds of the University for Peace, a United Nations mandated university located in Oradeo, Costa Rica. On July 21st, the university served an eviction notice to the radio station staff. Armed guards employed by the university locked the station's access gate and patrolled the premises. We're joined on the phone right now by James Latham, who's CEO of Radio for Peace International, speaking to us from inside the locked studios. Can you describe what is happening right now?
Thank you, Amy. The staff of RFPI are held up here at the radio station. We're determined not to leave for fear of the station being shut down or damaged. We are very concerned about the future of the radio station and its various projects. We are viewing this as an illegal act and an act that is against our basic human rights. Those being freedom of speech under Article 19 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, as well as to be dealt with in a dignified way. We have supporters that are listeners to the station that are coming out and holding vigilance outside the gates to kind of watch, to be witness to see what happens in this. We have until August 4th, according to the note that was handed us by the University for Peace lawyer to vacate the premise and to remove our stuff.
How did this happen, and what can you do at this point, and what can people do here?
Well, this was a process with a new administration that came into power a couple years ago. Let me say that RFPI has worked with five administrations here at the University for Peace in a very harmonious way, without any difficulties. The new administration is headed by Maurice Strong. And we believe that there is the reasons, which is often asked, why would the University for Peace want to shut down such a valuable asset as a radio station dedicated to peace? We believe the reasons for that are a difference in ideology between the new administration and the radio station. We're asking for the University for Peace Council to take note of this. We're not sure if they've been advised regarding this action. We're not sure if they've been advised that the buildings and the transmitting facility and the whole project has not been funded by the University for Peace, but by our listeners to the radio station.
Maurice Strong, founder of the World Economic Forum and special advisor to the president of the World Bank.
Exactly. And this is why the radio station over the last 3 years, broadcasting programs such as Democracy Now! And others that clearly took a critical look at the social justice issues of globalization. I think this clearly places us in a different camp from the University for Peace's current administration. We like to say that they believe in peace and security, and we're fighting for peace and justice.
Well, James Latham, we'll continue to find out what happens in these next few days as you remain inside the Lock Studios, CEO of Radio for Peace International in Costa Rica. I want to thank you for being with us. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a video or audio copy of the show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Lenina Nadal. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.